Fright Film Radio at the Torino Film Festival. I'm Angelo Cerbi. I'm really pleased to have him here with me as a guest, Mr. Julian Temple. Hello, how are you?
Hello, yes, very good.
You are here in Torino as a guest director, so you were asked to choose some movies to present to the public, and which criteria did you use to choose yours?
Well, I'm also presenting a film called The Ecstasy of Wilco Johnson, so... In that film, which is about a musician who started in the early 70s with a wonderful band called Dr. Feelgood, but who horribly was told he only had a few months to live a couple of years ago. And so it's the story of how he deals with that, which he dealt with in an incredibly inspiring way, I felt. But in making the film, he's many things, but he's a great literary expert. He's a lover of reading and English literature, and he throws quotations into, you know, if he can get into a taxi, he can get Milton somehow in the conversation with the cab driver as he gets in. And the cab driver has no idea, but his whole life is throwing quotations into every day. And I had to find a way of visually matching those quotations. So I tried to remember films that I'd seen in the early 70s that had really stayed with me. That was a wonderful time to watch movies, because there were a lot of cinemas in London showing old Hollywood movies, Bergman movies, Cocteau movies, a real mixture of great movies in very run-down cinemas. Mm-hmm. I used to like slumping in the seat and seeing the fleas jump in front of the
seat. Oh, really?
So I was trying to evoke that, and I chose films that dealt with this idea of contemplating the fact you're going to die and how you deal with that and how that focuses you on what's so great about being alive, you know. So the selection comes from that, really.
And I have to thank you publicly, because you chose one of my best movie ever, which is The Power and Press Burger, A Matter of Life and Death, which is not a very famous, not the most famous movie they did, but it's
one of the most magical, certainly, and to see it in a restored print like that on a big screen, it's visually one of the most beautiful movies you can see. I think the Technicolor in that, and the irony that heaven is in black and white
and life is in color,
on earth is in Technicolor, is kind of the right way around.
Keep on talking about your new movie, The Ecstasy of Wilco Johnson. We can say it's like a follow up of Old City Confidential, which was a movie about Dr. Feelgood again.
Yeah, it is and it isn't, because it's not really about Wilco as a musician. I mean, obviously, the fact he is a musician, I think, gave him certain strengths to deal with being told he was going to die. I think musicians do get up on stage and somehow leave everything else behind. They really are in the moment of being alive when they're playing, in a way more than other people. So when he was faced with all this going and he was going to die, I think that freedom that he had in terms of connecting to being alive as a musician probably helped him. But having said that, it's not a film about his music, so it's not really what happened to the guitarist of Dr. Feelgood after Dr. Feelgood. It's hopefully a very universal story about something that's going to happen to every one of us.
Me,
our mother, our friends. You know, so it's something we can relate to without knowing anything about Wilco's music. But I think the key is that he is a very relatable to... He's very unlikely and very surprising and strange, but very deeply human and warm, generous.
And person. It's kind of an inspiring character also, because you can... It gives you maybe an option if you are faced with such terrible news, an option to choose from that you maybe even never thought about, you know, to react
but
so lively, so instead of just sink in your despair.
He shows that it can be an enjoyable experience, bizarrely. And it's not what you would exactly. think would yeah. be enjoyable, but surely it is better to enjoy it rather than let it terrify you and oppress you.
Right, yeah.
And Wilco shows that you can fight it and deal with it and bizarrely enjoy it. That's the weirdest thing to say. And obviously, one of the most surprising things to me was, which I didn't expect, when he was finally told he was going to live, he became very depressed. he had to return to real life in the way that he was before this enlightening moment that he'd had. And it was difficult for him. I think now it was difficult because he didn't have the strength to play after this terribly big operation. Mm-hmm. So he became depressed partly because he couldn't play, but now he's out playing again. I think he's a lot stronger.
Yeah. So he got over this
depression. I hope. I think it's not easy though. I mean, it's much harder than you think.
Yeah, I can imagine. Yeah. Especially if your life was based on only on that, you have to stop it right away. Yeah. It's something that really.
So the film is fascinating in that way.
I wanted to ask you, as a director, you jumped from documentary to fiction pretty alternatively. And which is the best
form
that you, or the one that suits you the most, let's say it?
Well, I don't really differentiate between them. I would like to make fiction films in the way I make documentaries, and I'd like to make documentaries as though they're fiction films, which I try and do. I think the freedom of documentary is something fantastic because you're working with a very small crew, you're responding to events around you in a very free way, you're taking a lot of risks because you're able to, whereas in a fiction context where there's more money at stake and a bigger crew and everyone's got a script and you've got to stick to
it. Yeah,
I find that a little bit restricting. Although I think the medium of fictional movies is beyond anything else. I think it's a fantastic.
Talking about that, your first feature film, Absolute Beginners, was like for me, for a lot of people, was a huge thing because that opening sequence was really astonishing. The movie at those times didn't have like a very easy life.
No.
But it's
on the contrary.
But it is still very considered now. So what do you think about that?
Well, it's ironic, isn't it? That I mean, it's been basically orbiting Pluto for about 3 decades, and now it's coming back towards the sun. I don't know what the journey is. I mean, I know I kind of had to leave England because of that film, because no one would give me a job after that. And in America, bizarrely, one of the first things that happened to me was I got a phone call and said, "Hello, is that Julian?" I said, "Yeah, who's this?" He said, "It's Michael here." "Michael who?" "You know, Michael Jackson." I said, "Fuck off." "Oh, it's Michael. I've got a print of your film. You know, me and Janet." You know, they invited me to see them dance. Mm-hmm. All the dance moves they'd learned, and they did it beneath the screen at their house, so I had to go and watch them dance beneath the screen. So some people liked it even at the time. It's ironic. I mean, it was not a very hip thing to do a musical in the 80s, which is why I did it, actually. It's a bit of a punk.
Yeah, even if it was not exactly a musical in the proper sense, like the Hollywood musical were. I mean, it had some British
social issues, and it was about the history of the teenage idea and the music. You know, I'm sure it's it's resilient. Anyway, let's put it.
Oh yeah,
way.
Absolutely.
It's still going after all.
And have you ever thought of what you could have done differently if you have the chance on that specific movie?
I could have cast it differently. But I know I didn't have total control of the casting. But there are lots of things you would do differently. You know, I would be naive if I think I couldn't have made it better. And I think we made a lot of mistakes, particularly in publicizing it. Because at that time, we were pretty young at that time, and they didn't like the idea of young film directors. Now, unless you're young, it's very hard to make a film. But in those days, if you were young, it was like, come back in 40 years, you know, go away and sweep the studio floor and then make tea and then...
Then maybe you can
maybe
come back.
In 40 years' time, yeah, you could direct a film. And we were like, no, we want to do it now. And they were saying, no, go away. So we had to create a lot of publicity about the film in the magazines of the time to then show the guys who finance movies, look, they're interested in this movie, these books. So we created a kind of hype of the movie very early on, and it became a out of control thing, and it snowballed and snowballed. So there were cartoons in all the newspapers about this film, national news stories about it, people were reviewing it before we'd finished it. Yeah. You know, I mean, it was a crazy situation. It couldn't really win in that situation.
So that thing built up a bigger expectation.
Yeah, it's a bad thing to do. I would never do that again. Mm-hmm. That's one thing I've learned. Don't make noise about something until you've actually got something to make noise about, really.
Which is a pretty good statement to remember. Yeah. One last question. Which is your next project?
I've got two projects, which, interestingly, one is a fiction film and one is a documentary. I'm in the middle of editing a documentary about Havana in Cuba, the music, but also the city, the story of the city, the choices facing the city, the soul of the city. Mm. A kind of time travel through the vibe of Havana, which is fascinating. And then I'm doing a film next year, hopefully, about the brothers in The Kinks. But it's a drama, a fiction movie of this extraordinary sibling rivalry that spirals way out of control, and they're trapped in the same band and under the spotlight of fame, so they can't really get out of it. You know, they're locked into this bizarre, like two ferrets in a sack, you know. Yeah. but there's a lot of love involved as well. I mean, it's not all hate. There's a dynamic that's very fascinating, very strange, which created great music. You know, when they did come together,
yeah,
there was something about the sparks between them that made them very influential. They created forms of music that, you know, that riff, "You Really Got Me," launched 60s guitar and heavy metal. Yeah. They were the first kind of glam rock guys. David Bowie was the big fan in the front row, you know, when Dave was camping it up. And, they were, you know, punk before punk. Their
punk
attitude
before
was
punk, yeah,
very
exactly,
more
yeah.
punk. Like in America, the Rolling Stones agreed to cut their hair to go on the Ed Sullivan show. Pink's
no, thank
way.
You.
But they got banned for 4 years in America as a result of their attitude. So. But anyway, they were very influential, and I think that comes from this bizarre energy between these two brothers. You know,
at the end, music is always in your chords. I mean, in your movies, there's always music. One way or the other.
Well, I grew up at the right time in London to really, you know, when I was a school kid, these bands like the Kinks or the Stones or the Who were making music in London for young London people. You know, we were the audience that it was directed at, and we were learning somehow through the music how to see the world in a different way from the school was your teachers were telling you, your parents were telling you. There was something, you know, of a kind of philosophy in the music that inspired me then and still inspires me, really. I mean, I do love, you know, I don't know if it's maybe too much to say there is a philosophy in rock and roll, but I think if you approach it in the right way, you can extract your own one from it, you know.
Exactly. Well, thank you. Thank you very much. Julian Temple, for ever being with us.
Nice to be here. On Fred.
On Fred Radio from the Torino Film Festival. I'm Angelo Cerbi for Fred the Festival Insider.
Fred Film Radio. 24/7 on Fred.fm and smartphone apps.